welcome to the Hoop Collective podcast. We talk about the NBA, and the finals are over, and here comes the draft and the offseason. It actually already started, in case anyone missed Anthony Davis being traded over the weekend. And we have two of my favorite, most respected coworkers here. Both of these guys are just absolute experts in their field. I'm not just saying it because they're here. I rely on their intelligence daily, and they are absolutely at the top of their field. Both of them are in Bristol at ESPN headquarters because it's just absolute wall-to-wall for us at this point. We've got Bobby Marks, our front office insider, but really he knows everything about the NBA. Hey, Bobby, how are you?
Hello, Brian. How are you?
Good. And we've got Mike Schmitz, who works as hard as anybody out there, knows the draft, goes and sees the guys, is out there working like a full-time NBA scout, working probably harder than some of the NBA scouts.
Oh, he's working harder. Trust me.
Mike, how are you? You hanging in there?
You've got a I'm good. Here. I'm fired up. I appreciate the very kind intro.
Before we go into the draft, Bobby, I just wanted to ask you, there's something happening right now in the league that no one's really talking about, and I think it's pretty damn important, and that is what's happening potentially with the Wizards and Masai Ujiri. Woj reported the night that the Raptors won the title that the Wizards are trying to get Masai out of Toronto. I have heard that there's been at least some communication between the franchises, and Toronto has expressed that if they're going to give up Masai Ujiri, they would like to have significant compensation. This has happened before. I wouldn't say it's normal. Washington, it seems relatively transparent that they're doing something here because they stopped interviewing people for their general manager job and the draft is in a few days and they haven't made a hire. This is a delicate situation that Masai is at the parade today. You know, we're recording this on Monday night and there's probably stuff going on behind the scenes trying to steal him away. What's your viewpoint of what's going on here?
Well, obviously, Brian, that they're, you know, they've been in this holding pattern after they, you know, interviewed Tommy Shepard and Danny Ferry and Troy Weaver. And now we're, you know, the finals ends on last Thursday and then, you know, the Masai report comes out. And so obviously, you know, they kind of have been targeting him or if they weren't, they would have just given, you know, Tommy Shepard, Danny Ferry, the job here. And the timing of this, as you know, we're 3 days or 4 days away from the draft. They've got the 9th pick in the draft and they've got 7 or 8 of their own free agents, and not to mention, you know, Bradley Beal hanging out there to do with him. And I don't know how much longer they can wait here, you know, for this. And what is the right draft? What is the right compensation that Washington would be? What they would be willing to give up the 9th pick in the draft?
Well, that's what I'd ask for if I was Toronto.
Yeah. and it's ironic that they're giving up the 9th pick in Masai is coming to a weaker product without that there. So yeah, if I was Toronto, I would probably want the 9th pick in this year's draft for to let go of his services.
Yeah, so he's under contract for 2 more years, I believe, with Raptors. What's the protocol? And now you were involved in a coach trade.
We were, right? Jason Kidd. Yeah, we got 2 second round picks from Milwaukee. And we actually had to do a trade call with the league like we were doing with a player. We didn't have to share like medical or insurance information on Jason Kidd, but we had to do it. And we actually did it right after we interviewed Lionel Hollins for the job. I went back to the office and we did the call like at 10:30 at night. And the protocol is that you agree on the compensation and then you got to do a trade call with the NBA.
So the protocol though is like what we see a lot of times when people are trying to hire it away, you know, you ask for permission, etc. This has got to be a little bit dicey because I'm making a supposition. I'm not reporting this. I want to be clear. If Masai wasn't interested in the job, the Wizards wouldn't have waited, right? I mean, there's got to be some there's got to be something there.
There had been some type of inclination that there was interest, or you're right, they would have, they would have hired somebody by now. That to kind of wait until, the draft, the finals ended last Thursday, and then all of a sudden now we're going to kind of kick it in gear that he's, we would like to meet with him. Yes, there had to have been something there for them to wait.
Yeah. That's just an interesting scenario. I'm trying to think about when I remember Kevin Pritchard, got fired by the Trailblazers on draft day. So I guess it's not impossible for a team to make a change this late. When I was covering go ahead.
We had it in Jersey, Bri. In 2010 when, Rod Thorne had, I think like 2 weeks before the draft, announced that he was going, or told ownership that he was going to retire. And he, we didn't hire, so Rod conducted the draft and did free agency. And then Billy King was hired, I think, in like late July or early August. So it's not similar, but you're kind of going in, you have somebody else picking the players who will have nothing to do with them in the future.
It's strange, and it's definitely something that no one's talking about because, Anthony Davis and the Raptors and all this and winning the championship. But I think it's pretty fascinating. And, if Masai comes in there, whoever comes in there, there could be some movement there and some changes. But we'll talk about that later. Mike, I will be the first to say, and I say this to everybody, I do not have the bandwidth to keep up with the draft. So I really yield to your expertise. I know next to nothing about most of these players. I know about the team needs. I know about some of the talks about movement. So everybody who I talk to briefly tells me that this is the draft breaks after three picks, that the top three picks where you want to be, and the difference between the three pick and the four pick is the most significant. Mike, are you in agreement with that? Where are you on your evaluation of this top end of this draft?
I think that in terms of guys who have proven themselves at the collegiate level, I think that's true. With a guy like Zion, John Morant, and RJ Barrett, these are three guys where they have all-star potential, and you've seen them do it for 30-plus games at the collegiate level. From a talent perspective, I think that if Darius Garland was healthy and played a full season at Vanderbilt and didn't have the injury, that we would be calling this a four-player draft. And I think that in 2-3 years – once he gets settled in the NBA and people really start to see how much talent this kid has, I think we're going to be looking back and saying we should have been calling this a four-player draft. I think he was obviously robbed of that opportunity to show his skill set. But, I mean, coming into the season, he was the number one point guard on our board. He was a guy I thought was going to kind of have a Trae Young effect at the collegiate level in terms of, bombing 35-foot threes and scoring a lot of points. And he's not that level of passer. But I do think that while those three guys have proven themselves, I think that Garland really, from a talent perspective, deserves to be in that conversation.
Well, you've gone so far as to – I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you have compared him – stylistically, I don't know if you think talent wise, but at least stylistically, you've compared him to Damian Lillard.
Yes. I just think in terms of his range, in terms of how he gets to a shot off the dribble, the step back package, his change of pace, a guy who, Dame was probably a little more bouncy coming out, but Dame also took a few years, to...
He was 3 years older, right?
Right, 3 years older. And, had to kind of prove himself at Weber State. So just in terms of their style of play, I think there are some similarities. And then also a guy who can play a little bit off the ball as well. Like Garland, when I first saw him as a 14-year-old, which sounds crazy, at USA Basketball in 2014, he was this 135-pound spot-up shooter, right? And so... he was really a spot-up shooter early on in his career, and he's a guy who I think because of that, at least offensively, can play with, a guy like CJ McCollum and can play with another ball handler also. So that's what makes him attractive. But to me, if you're just looking at like a lot of the point guards that are having success in today's NBA, I think it's guys, you know, who can shoot it with range off the dribble and who can, you know, make at least the necessary reads as a playmaker. But like, it's a shot making ball screen heavy league. And I think he fits right into that.
So Bobby, if Mike is this high on him, my guess is that there's some other people out on the trail who feel the same way, which is why I think there's some significant interest in getting this number four pick off of the Pelicans, who are making it available. And just in general, the ground is sort of fertile for movement, I feel like, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, but the ground is sort of fertile for movement between four and eight. For some reasons I'm going to go over here. One, because there's a couple of teams outside the top four who want point guards, primarily the Chicago Bulls. And I think the Suns may be interested in an off guard or a guy who can play with Booker. Certainly not an off guard, but certainly a combo guard at the very least. And those guys, they're at six and seven. And then at eight, you have the Hawks, who, while they may not be interested in Garland because they have a good backcourt, I don't know, maybe they are. I don't have intel. They have three first-round picks and I think three seconds and may be primed to move up in this draft. Do you see that? Am I at least on the right path at all here with my analysis?
No, you're right. I mean, I think we're looking at point guards here after Ja Morant is that you've got Darius Garland and Kobe White as your prime, you know, your point guards. And I think there's some drop off, right, Mike, after those guys. We've got players that are ranked in the I think in the 20s here. And for Phoenix, I know a point guard is a high priority for them just because of where they are financially this summer, unless they clear some money out to go out and get a good free agent point guard. And the same with, I think, John Paxson, he's been pretty clear that Chris Dunn is not the point guard of the future here.
That's so true.
How do you, is there going to be, you're at five right now. Is it, you know, what will it cost you to move up a slot to, you know, to number four? And then you made the point with Atlanta. Yeah. Atlanta controls or has, you know, controls the draft after the top three with, you know, 8, 10, 17, and then three in the second round. So
they have early seconds too.
They've got, I think, two in the 30s and one in the 40s or maybe one in the 30s. And that's another thing too, Brian, is that, you know, the more teams you talk to, that teams are willing to move out of the first round if they can get two really good seconds. And if you are, it's like Philadelphia, it's got, I think, 33 and 34. Like, teams would move out of the 20s to get, if you can get to two, which are almost like first round picks here. I think, in that 4 to 8, I mean, as we said, like, the draft starts at four. I mean, we could talk about Zion and Ja and RJ all we want, but once we get to four, it really opens up.
Yeah. So Mike, do you see it the same way, that really, that there's a desire for those point guards when there maybe is more of a demand than there is supply in the top 10?
Yeah, for sure. I think, especially looking at our board, just kind of how we have it with, you know, Garland and then Kobe White, and then it is a big drop. I think the next guy, you know, you're really looking at is Ty Jerome, who we have, I think, 25th in our top 100. You know, there are some combo guards and some guys who I think can play it in a pinch. And I'm probably higher on Ty Jerome than most. But yeah, there's certainly a demand from those two teams, no question.
So I'm interested in Ty Jerome a little bit. I don't want to talk too much about him right now, but obviously I watched the NCAA tournament and I watched the Virginia senior guards, or at least if they weren't senior guards, they were experienced guards. He sort of fits that mold of, we often see, you know, I know he's not the exact same player, but he kind of reminded me of the value of Jalen Brunson to Villanova a year ago. A really good experienced guard, and sure enough, Jalen Brunson comes into the league and plays really well, you know. So, is he a guy who you could see making somewhat of an impact quickly?
Yeah, I think he's one of the biggest sleepers in the draft. I really do. I think that he's going to be a guy who starts a lot of NBA games eventually. And if you're getting that, I mean, if you're getting that in, you know, whether he ends up going in the late teens or early 20s, I think that's incredible value. So, yeah, he's one of these veteran guys who you say, oh, he's got short arms, or he's got a bad body, or he can't get by anybody. And he's been doing it his entire life. He's been winning his entire life. He plays angles. He shoots it. He's got an incredible feel. He's a big-time leader. That's a guy who I would really, really look at, even if I were a team looking like in the mid-teens, late lottery, if I, you know, needed kind of a changing of the guard at point guard. And he's got size to play off the ball, too. So I'm very, very high on him.
Let's talk about the Duke guys a little bit. I think Zion Williamson, I think most of our listeners are probably pretty familiar with him. But first off, what position do you think he plays in the NBA?
I think he's a guy who you start games at the four, and then, you know, if you're playing your death lineup type of lineup, right, I think he's a closing five. You know, I think you can fit him in a lot of different ways because of his defensive versatility, and that's kind of what makes him attractive. But I do think that, like, what's going to make him most unique and most effective is the fact that he has the size in terms of strength, and he has the rim protection to actually exist at that position on one end of the floor. And then on the other end, like, put any center out, you know, you name it, whether it's Gobert, Capella, Steven Adams, and have them try and guard him in space. You know, I think it's he has a better chance of stopping them than they do of him. So I've kind of been banging that drum in terms of he's a guy who could really excel at that position. Does that mean he's going to play, you know, 82 games and every minute there? No, but I think that's what I like about him, is that he can give you that different look. And we've seen a lot of teams have success with that.
Please leave a message after the tone.
Let's talk about debt. It is a massive problem for many. And the truth is, traditional credit card companies don't do much to help. All those fees, reward programs that make you want to spend, and unexpected interest charges. A lot of people get into financial trouble this way. But I just learned about a new kind of credit card company, and it's completely changed the way people can think about credit cards. This is a new company called Pedal. And it was started by a group of people who were sick of old school credit card companies. That's why their Visa card has no fees, and their mobile app is designed to help you manage your spending responsibly. Pedal's cash back program rewards you for doing the right thing. You earn 1% cash back right away, and up to 1.5% cash back when you make 12 on-time payments. Pedal is a great modern option for anyone, but especially those who are just starting to build credit, because you can qualify even if you've never had credit in the past. Pedal partners with WebBank, member FDIC. And as of today, the Pedal Visa variable APRs range from 15.24% to 26.24%. It's about time a credit card company helped you succeed financially. Check out the Pedal credit card. It's responsible credit for the modern world. To get more information, you go to pedalcard.com/hoop. That's Pedal with a T, P-E-T-A-L, card.com/hoop.
Yeah, you know, Bobby, it seems to me that the Pelicans, especially since they're making this fourth pick available, seems to me like they intend to have a competitive team immediately. If you look at this, move that they made, then they're going to keep Drew Holiday, it seems, and then you know, Brandon Ingram and Zion as your forwards. Seems to me that they really want to. They think that Zion's going to make an impact right away, and that they want to. I think Griff intends to have a playoff competitor, like a team that can make the playoffs, which is very unusual for a team with the number one pick.
And I think how this Western Conference is going to probably shape up, that they'll have a, you know, certainly an opportunity. And it's the old, you know, it's the stealing the script from the Clippers, right? I mean, it's like the retool, not rebuild. Not hitting ground zero, just taking back draft picks where you get three players in Ingram, Ball, and Hart. And, you know, and then, of course, with Zion at number one, and we don't know where four is going to be. It could be
It could be a player like Darius Garland, or it could be maybe moved back to 8 and 17, and now you have multiple assets here. So yeah, I think the goal is to be competitive.
I guess what I mean is they're looking for a player at number four. They're not looking for multiple picks.
Yes. If they can get, of course, if they can get into play with, an established player, we'll see where that comes out, and a guy can come in and all-star level would be hard, I think, Brian. I think, it's the hard part, too, is that, we've got so many free agents out there, and, we've got, 60% of the league that's tradable. So the pool of guys really shrinks down, and I think – but you have now the assets from the Lakers. So if you want to go really all in and target a player, then you can push some of these chips in that you didn't have before.
Right. Okay, so Mike, RJ Barrett, he was number one. Was he number one on your board start of the season, or was that still Zion? I know you're a big Zion believer. I know that.
Yeah, he was number one. It was kind of more a product of just everything he had accomplished at that point, right? Like, he was this physical, aggressive, alpha dog type of guy early on, FIBA with the Canadian national team at Montverde. Like, he was clearly separated himself as the best player in his high school class. And so that's kind of what we rode with going into the year. And then, I think the fact that Ja emerged the way he did, I'm not sure anyone could have seen that coming, at least to this level. And then Zion as well. Like, Zion started the season at, I want to say – four on our maybe, he wasn't, I don't even know if he was in the top three. I think there were a lot more questions about him than it's been made, than people think. But yeah, I think RJ is a plug and play guy who's didn't have a lot of space to operate at Duke, and his game's built for the NBA.
I mean, he did average 19 points. I mean, if you average 20 points in the ACC, mm-hmm. especially on a team that has a bunch of talent on it, you got to have a lot going for you. That's, I've always sort of, I am not a talent evaluator, but I have always sort of said, listen, if you can score at a high level in the power conference, that's one of the things I always thought about. I remember, Malcolm Brogdon winning ACC player of the year. And I know he had a foot injury, but I was like, damn, if you're ACC player of the year, you can play in the NBA. I feel like he's going to score.
Yeah, he's going to score. And I think he's gotten nitpicked, because of how great Zion has been. You're looking at, this superhero type of player that we've never seen, just some of the physical feats that he's accomplishing. And then you look at RJ and you're like, he's 6'7", he's strong, but he's not Zion. He's averaging 22-7-4 at 18 years old, but it's not the best player efficiency rating we've seen in the last 10 years, and I think he kind of fell victim to that. And then you look at the situation and the fact that Duke ranked 327th in the country in shoot 3-point percentage, and he's right. Kind of a head down aggressive driver, and there's a reason his true shooting percentage wasn't what people would hope. So, I think he's been kind of scrutinized more than he should have been.
Andrew, you had a question?
Yeah, go ahead. Long-time listener, first-time caller. Hi, my name.
Oh, welcome to the show.
Can you put this draft in a little bit of context for me? Because everyone talks, Brian said off the top, it's supposedly a three-player draft. Maybe it's a four-player draft. But, using the guys the Pelicans just got, Lonzo and Ingram, for example, where would they fall if they were in the draft this year?
Yeah, I think – I mean, when Lonzo was coming out, obviously he was, he had some doubters, but there's a reason he went as high as he did. I think both of those guys would be considered, top five or six picks. I think for me, outside of Garland, maybe I'm a little bit on an island in terms of thinking that he belongs in that top four, but I think a lot of teams see starters and rotation players. There are some guys that you can swing on. Like a Bol Bol or Kevin Porter or Romeo Langford, some guys with some upside. But to me, outside of those four guys, it's kind of just a bunch of dudes in terms of role starters, potential rotation players, and then guys you take a swing on. So I think that those guys would be near the top half of the top 10 at least.
Let me ask you about Cam Reddish. I think in Gavoni's latest mock draft that came out today, which you can get on ESPN Plus, he had him going as far as eighth, low eight to the Hawks. He's had a bit of a disappointment. I mean, I wouldn't have thought he would have been eighth going into the season. Is he had a little disappointing run here? You think he goes that low?
I could see it. I really could. You know, he dealt with the injury, obviously, that's kind of shut down his workouts. So, and I did think that the pre-draft process was kind of built for a guy like him who, you know, he looks like a top three pick, right? He's got all the measurables. And when you put him, you know, in kind of a one-on-one workout setting, like I was at his pro day, and, you know, we could argue the value of pro days either way. But, I mean, he looked like he should be the number two pick in the draft, just like in a gym by himself. You know, everything is so natural to him. He shoots it so easy. He's really fluid. But I mean, he just had a bad year, you know, like he did not have a great year. And I think there are some other guys during the process that have helped themselves too, you know, like, Sekou Doumbouya, I think is a guy who's rising, you know, he's not a household name, but, he's a guy who could go ahead of Reddish. People feel comfortable with Culver and Hunter because they're safe and they're proven. And then there's teams like Phoenix or Chicago who maybe need point guards. So I think that kind of pushes Cam, you know, maybe in more into that eight range where you see, you know, Gavoni had a mock.
So, Bobby, one of the things we hear a lot about right this time of year is which players were willing to work out for which teams. Just something the agents try to sort of gear players to certain teams. Sometimes you hear about guys who won't work out because they may have a promise as they try to, you know, go through that process. For example, I think Gavoni reported today that DeAndre Hunter, who was obviously a star of the NCAA tournament at Virginia, only worked out for the Hawks. Is getting a guy in for a workout a big deal when it comes to selecting people?
No, it's not. I think a bigger deal is that you have their medical information and that you've got you know, your background is you're buttoned up on your background from college coaches or if you did a private eye background on him. I think the medical is more important. I mean, shoot, we went through a stretch in Jersey where we drafted like four guys and none of them ever even came in and worked out. And maybe bringing a guy in for a workout, we probably should have. It was like Sean Williams, Anton White, Josh Boone, and Marcus Williams. And that group never even stepped foot in 390 Murray Hill Parkway. So maybe, yeah, but no, I'm not a big believer in the draft workout. I mean, in 2010, we had DeMarcus Cousins go against Derek Favors one-on-one, and it was like a steel cage match. And I don't know how much that tells you from the individual.
It was fun to watch.
And there was a lot of begging coming in because neither guy wanted to work out against each other. I think too, what you're probably seeing too now, Brian, is a lot of teams lying to agents. And what they're doing is they're saying, well, we're at 22, and I think we, you know, there's a chance we can get to 8. And can we get Cam Reddish in to work out? That is the MO of teams of how they kind of conduct this process. But no, I think, you know, like Darius Garland's interesting, right? Like from what I've heard is that, you know, with the medical, as far as how much of the sharing of the medical has been going on with him. You know, we saw it last year with, Jaren Jackson Jr. And I think with Memphis, and at the last minute, the Grizzlies wind up getting his medical. But I would be scared off more if we didn't have, you know, the medical compared to if the player even came in.
Yeah, I've definitely heard about some secret, not public workouts that Darius Garland has had in the last week. Some teams sniff around four. So we'll see. That could definitely be an interesting position. You mentioned the private eye stuff, like hiring an investigator. What are those reports like? Because I have seen some stuff over the years. What are you looking for in something like that?
Criminal background. Mm-hmm. Less. This is more of, you know, we had a private eye that we basically planted on campus for a 2-week stretch. It's a thorough. I mean, it's expensive. It's a thorough report on basically everything and anything about that player. A little bit different than when our scouts go out and call coaches and academic advisors and strength coaches and stuff. But yeah, it's a thorough. I mean, I got you know, baptism under fire. And when I first started with the Nets in 95, I think I was an intern and I got my hands on a private eye report and on a player. And it was like, whoa, is this happen? Is this real? So yeah, I mean, I think that's what you're looking for. It's the stuff that you can't find on Google. It's the stuff that you can't find by calling the head coach at Duke or Kentucky that you're not going to get. There's always some little things out there that you can pry from by doing that.
It might be the kind of stuff that Schmitz and Gavoni know because they're out there traveling the world and they're not affiliated. Really, you know, so Mike, don't you get teams sniffing at your door to try to get information from you that you may have access to because you don't wear a team logo when you're at an event?
I think that's the benefit. You know, you can get a little bit more information from different sides of it, and you know, you can be friends with everybody, right?
Yeah.
So I think that certainly helps, and even like just the social media side of things now, right? Like, I think it's important for these kids to understand that every single tweet, every Snapchat, every my story on Instagram, like all that is being watched like heavily, you know, and some of these teams even have like, you know, different ways to, you know, kind of put together a report just with technology of like, these are the phrases that these guys are using the most. These are the, you know, what they're liking. This is what it goes so deep. Yeah, it's a crazy time we're living in, but hey, these guys are multi-million-dollar investments, right? So you got to get it right.
So Bobby, what is it like on draft day in a war room? Either both leading up to the draft and then during the draft itself.
Well, the process has been going on for a while as far as the workouts. Now in New Jersey and Brooklyn, the Sunday before the draft was the day that we would set up the board. You know, you have all your scouts in town, and you would do your, you know, your top 60 board. And it would be, you know, it would be a lot of debating and as far as what, you know, how you rank it. And that's a preliminary list. And then what you do is you basically, the days leading up, you kind of massage the board. And it's based on medical psych background. You can move guys around. So the initial board is just based on talent alone with the input from scouts. And then, you know, based on where you're picking, you're starting to take guys in groupings. And you're kind of starting narrowing players down. But there's a lot of, you know, a lot of different things you can do. We were talking about it earlier, like, you know, one of the things exercise that we did, Brian, was you put dollar signs next to picks, right? So when you go into the draft night, you know what the pick 34 sold for, you know, 2 years ago. So if you want to buy, you have, you know, some type of parameters. But I always said, like, the night of the draft is like working on, like, being a Wall Street, you know, on the stock exchange floor. You know, there's just a lot of action going on, even if you're kind of in the second round, you know, it's constant calling, trying to move up, trying to move around. You basically have all your options listed. Most of the time going into the night of the draft, you kind of have a good idea as far as where you can go and what will it cost. But yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I always compare it to kind of be like, you know, working at Wall Street.
Hey, Bobby, how much intel would you have on what other teams were going to do?
Well, yeah, that's what you rely on your scouts, right? So like you on the board, you would have, you know, with certain names, you would have, you know, Terrence Williams, New Jersey, Brooklyn, New Jersey, Atlanta, Boston. So that's kind of where, you know, those are the three teams that like him. So that would kind of give you some sense that where that player's range is going to be. So teams are willing to share, you know, they're not going to certainly not share on their own, but yeah, I mean, that's where you basically rely on your scouts to go out and get that info.
How much, seriously, like, this is a sort of a new phenomenon in the last 5 to 8 years, but how much is what Woj is doing affecting what's going on in those draft rooms?
Well, I mean, we knew that's who we relied on. You know, right. I mean, we did. I mean, so basically, what you have is you have somebody in your front office on the phone. There's a conference call number with all the other teams in with the league office, and they're the ones who you like as far as when the pick is coming in. But it was like, you know, Woj was the one, like, we relied on him to find out who was picking it ahead, and it helped. I mean, it basically gave us like a head start as far as, you know, it doesn't put you on the clock right away, because we know that, you know, at pick 17, Minnesota was picking, you know, Rashard McCants. And if you're at 18, you had basically an extra 2 or 3 minutes to figure out what you're going to do.
Right. So I actually did a story one time in a draft room, and, one thing, you know, first off, I think the maybe it's all electronic billboards now, but the standard, right, is you're in a room completely surrounded by magnetic whiteboards, and you have like magnetic things on the whiteboards and notes around them. Is that the standard draft room, you think?
Yes. Oh yeah. Yep.
Sometimes, you know, at least when I was there, the coach had a different top five than the front office had a different top five, and this team had a top five pick. So, and that was up there. So that was a surprise. But like, I think the coach wanted to know the record that he had a different guy ranked ahead.
Well, you know what, too, Brian, we tried to get the less involvement of the head coach, the better.
Right? What about the, like, less involvement of the owner? Or keep the owner out of the room.
Yes, and the owner, like the coach, like, he spends a lot of time coaching the team, right? Like, he's not watching tape, you know. And if he is, it's May and June. It's basically playing catch up here. And then that's why, going back to the individual workouts, like, sometimes the worst thing to do is get a guy in your gym and have your coaches work with him and him like light up a workout and a coach falling in love. And then maybe he wasn't very good during the season, or maybe there's some character flaws here. And that's kind of another deterrent there.
I think I'm sure this has been many, many coaches, but I think Larry Brown was kind of known for that. He would see a guy to work out and fall in love was the rap. Yeah, so it's 5 minutes between picks, and at least when I was in the draft room, they were pretty. This was before Woj was breaking 8 picks in advance. This was probably of that, but they were generally aware of roughly about two picks in advance that night. Is that about right, you think, with on the conference call and just sources in the league, that you're about 2 picks ahead?
Yes, that is correct.
So you really have about like maybe 15 minutes, even though it's only five. Like, you have a general like 15 minutes, right?
You have a head start. Yes, you have a good head start.
But the second round, it's 2 minutes. And that's when a lot of picks get bought. And it was kind of my feel that like a call would come in and the negotiation would be like 6 seconds. Is that right, or is that wrong?
That's right. I mean, the funniest story from the second round was, we didn't have a first round pick 1 year, so we wound up buying 3 in the second round. It cost us like $5 million.
Oh my god! That was back before there was a limit on what you could spend, right?
Yeah, it was, and it turned into Markel Brown, Corey Jefferson, and Xavier Thames, and we got done. We got done at the end of the night, and then usually there's some adult beverages that come into play, like around midnight, right? And they get some pizza, and then we're looking at each other, and we're like, "Do we have roster spots for these guys?" And we're like, you know, we just spent like $2 million on Markel Brown and Xavier Thames. We had to send it to Europe and stuff. But yeah, that's why you just get caught up in the, you just get caught up, because guys that you think, you know, if you have a player ranked 22nd on your board, and when you get to pick 40, that player is still there, you get caught up in the emotion that, you know, let's buy it. You know, let's buy, you know, for $2.5-3 million.
Yeah, and it's like you sort of call and be like, you know, sometimes the team will be like, yeah, $1 million, or, you know, $2 million. You kind of got to decide pretty quick, right? I mean, you kind of have to know your budget going in. I mean, now it's a little bit more transparent because everybody has the limits about how much they can spend and how much they can receive. But it was just crazy the speed at which these purchases looked like they were going on to me in trades. So to go back to the board, Mike, you mentioned Sekou Doumbouya. Is that am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, close enough.
He seems to be, to me, again, I am not an expert, he seems to be one of the big risers during the draft process. He played in the in the French league last year.
Yeah.
Gavoni has him going ninth to the Wizards. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, he's been a known commodity really in Europe since he was 15. He was born in Guinea. He moved to France when he was one and really was kind of one of these early bloomer types who, you know, was impressing with his physicality, athleticism. He was playing pro when he was like 15 years old. He was actually on the same under 18 team as Frank Ntilikina in 2016. They won gold. He was 15 years old playing with under 18 guys. So like he's been this known guy forever. And then he kind of had some ups and downs the last few seasons in terms of his focus and maturity and things of that nature. And this past year has just completely turned it around. Like I went down to Limoges where he's been playing. It's 4 hours south of France. Not the most pleasant drive, but you know, south of Paris. Went down there twice and like he changed his body completely. He's really buying in. And then he had a pro day in Dallas with like 10 general managers, I think 3 NBA head coaches. And, you know, pro days aren't that valuable for college guys, but I think for players like him who, you know, NBA head coaches or GMs hadn't really seen, he really, really opened some eyes. He made a bunch of shots. He actually has measurements really similar to Pascal Siakam. And I think, you know,
he just said some magic words.
Exactly. I think the timing of Pascal's success and then watching this kid and just kind of saying, you know, he doesn't quite have that type of motor or feel, but, you know, I've heard he's had really, really impressive workouts. And I'd be surprised if he doesn't go in the top 10, to be honest. So
is he kind of the biggest riser in this draft? During the workout season, there's always one or two guys that go blasting up in these workouts.
Well, so we always had him high. Like I think our first ever mock draft, he was like 4, right?
So we've
always had him high, but when you talk to teams who went over and saw him this year, they're like, you know, he's probably more of a 15 to 20 guy. And I think it's tough in that European setting where like there's a lot of pressure. He's the youngest player in the draft. You know, he's playing maybe 12, 15 minutes. You fly all the way out there. You see one game. Like, he doesn't play great. And it's easy to say, like, oh, you know, he's going to go here or there. So he's always been kind of seen as, at least in our eyes, as this top 10 caliber guy. But I think through the process, he's kind of reminded people as to why.
Please leave a message after the tone.
Summer is almost here, and that means it's going to events season. Concerts, baseball games, playoff games, theater, everything that makes your summer memorable comes in the form of these great events. And when you want to go to an event and you want to get a good deal on the tickets, the answer is Vivid Seats. Vivid Seats is an online ticket marketplace dedicated to providing fans of live entertainment with those experiences that last a lifetime. With Vivid Seats, our listeners can watch their favorite teams and artists perform in person. Vivid Seats help fans find seats in those favorite live events, obviously sporting events, concerts, theater, and much more. And they do it with great prices and, most importantly, an easy purchasing experience. With the podcast code HOOPS, that's H-O-O-P-S, listeners can receive 10% off their first order with Vivid Seats. And, of course, as you know already, all Vivid Seats are confirmed and they're backed by 100% guarantee. So what do? You go to the App Store or Google Play and download the Vivid Seats app. The first-time customers can enter their promo code HOOPS, H-O-O-P-S, and receive 10% off that first order. Again, Vivid Seats to make this summer memorable.
One guy that I watched play a couple times during the regular season and was certainly impressed with, and Gavoni's got him in the lottery from Gonzaga, Rui Hachimura. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah.
Who's Japanese and really was a high energy, big time defensive player in what I saw. I think he to me was an intriguing prospect. Really just interesting, mostly because there's been almost no Japanese players. It's just been maybe a couple in my 17 years covering the NBA. You know, what do you see with him?
Yeah, he was, I think when he was like 15, they started calling him the Japanese Jordan. He was actually a like he's a huge deal over there. They had
don't quite have similar games, but okay.
No. I don't know if that's quite fair to him, but like, I mean, Gonzaga had their own media day this year with just Japanese reporters, and I think it was like 50, 60 people came. Yeah. Every game I went to scout, there were Japanese reporters. He's a huge deal over there. He was actually a baseball catcher before even playing basketball.
Well, that's what they do in Japan.
That's what they do in Japan. So, he kind of came late to the game. You know, he's been a known guy since he was 15, 16 years old, since he started playing, just because you look at him, right? Like, he's got Kawhi Leonard-sized hands and broad shoulders, and he's got all the physical attributes. And he improved every year. You know, I think teams feel pretty comfortable about him just seeing him for three seasons at Gonzaga, you know, the production he had. I think there are some questions still about, like, his basketball instincts, you know, and his ability to kind of read and react and think quickly on both ends of the floor, just because, you know, it doesn't come all that naturally to him. But, another guy I'd be surprised if he goes, you know, out of the lottery just because of the physical profile. He's a high character kid, and he was super, super productive.
Bobby, do you remember that Israeli player from about 20 years ago? The Sports Illustrated called him the Jewish Jordan. I can't remember. I think his last name was Goodman.
I do.
The Japanese Jordan. I like that. I hadn't heard that. It's probably very prevalent. I just hadn't heard that.
The best since Yuta Tabuse.
That's right. I actually saw Yuta Tabuse
Tamir
play.
Goodman.
Okay. Tamir Do you remember Goodman. Him? Do you remember the Jewish Jordan?
Tamir Goodman.
I saw Yuta Tabuse play. I think he played for the Suns and actually covered the World Championships in Japan in 2006. And he was the great Japanese hope. Did not make it. This guy, I think, has a chance to have a little bit more of a career. Mike, who's a guy you're in love with in this draft? Beyond those top couple of guys. If I was consulting with you, who would you say, boy, I saw this kid when he was 14 and I've loved him ever since?
Yeah, Nickeil Alexander-Walker is probably the name that comes to mind most for me. Maybe it's because he's Shea Gilgeous Alexander's first cousin and I was a big Shea fan. I'm not sure, but we've been following him since he was 16 years old, played at Virginia Tech. You know, I just think he's exactly what you're looking for in terms of a guy who can play on the ball, off the ball. He's 6'6", you know, close to a 6'10 wingspan, high IQ, tough competitor, played for Buzz Williams. He's probably going to go in the 15 to 20 range. And I think we're going to look back in a few years and say, wow, like this guy probably should have been a top 10 pick.
So we call Shea SGA. Will we call him NAW?
Nah. Nah. That's
it. People call him Nah.
Yeah, I've heard a few. I think we got to, you know, hop on that, get the branding going. He's, you know, it's all about the hyphenated names now.
Yeah, I remember when Andre Iguodala was coming out, nobody could pronounce his name. And they just called him, all the scouts would just call him Iggy. And it kind of stuck ever since. Bobby, I'm kind of interested in you talked earlier about medicals. Bol Bol, who's Manute Bol's son, had a very scary injury. He had a fractured navicular bone, which for a 7-footer, and he is 7'3", is about as scary of an injury as you can have. He had a workout in L.A. What happened with that workout, Mike? Did he look good last week in L.A.? I know was there a good positive coming out? You guys have him going pretty low at 20.
Yeah, he was. So I was actually in Bristol, but everything I had heard was that he really impressed. And you know, again, it's a 1-0 workout, and the dude is a freak talent. Like in terms of talent, he's a top 5 pick. So it's not shocking to me that he looked impressive. I think it, you know, eased some concerns for scouts just to kind of see him again in person and see him moving around and looking fluid and making shots. So I think, you know, again, as much as you don't want to put too much stock in that, there is some recency bias there to seeing just some of the things that he can do. Like there aren't many 7'3 guys who can do what he can do. Like Porzingis is maybe the only other one. in the league, like at that size, who can handle, shoot it on the move, protect the rim. So, yeah, to me, he's one of the most polarizing guys in the draft.
Bob, you got to kind of have a certain profile to take a guy who's coming off a disaster injury, right? I mean, not everybody can take it.
His medical would be on a separate table. where our doctors are, the doctors are, we're usually set up in a separate area outside your conference room, and with all their medicals, and he would have a special place. And basically, Brian, your doctor would have to, you know, really sell you on him as far as from a medical standpoint. And I think Mike, probably in this draft, where there is, you know, certainly some drop off, and you know, there's not that, you know, A-list player after, you know, some of the top three, four guys, you know, I think there's probably teams would be more willing to take the risk based on the upside, even with coming off the Nowicker. I don't know if you could say that in last year's draft, probably, since last year's draft was considered pretty strong. But yeah, your doctor, you know, what the medicals, the physical.
You had that with Brook Lopez, the multiple navicular fractures, right?
And it took for, I mean, Brook broke it in 2000, right after the lockout of, what was that, 2011? So he originally broke it in 11, broke it again in 12, broke it again in 13. So he had three
His career was basically on the brink.
You know, Dr. O'Malley did, you know, KD's Achilles last week, and I, you know, Dr. O'Malley is still the Nets team doctor. I said that, you know, he basically, you know, we thought Brook was done, you know, when he broke his foot in Philadelphia in 13, because of how many times he had done it, and he basically put a bionic foot on him. I mean, that's where he is right now. And you're always prone for that, to happen again.
Well, last year you had Michael Porter going to the Nuggets at 14 because they are stocked with good young players, and it would take a team that could afford to whiff on a young player. It was a team that could gamble, a team that was more desperate for talent probably couldn't, and that's why I assume that you guys in your mock and Gavoni here has him going to the Celtics, because the Celtics with three picks. They have three picks, right? Yeah, three picks. And Danny Ainge, he's got the capital to pull something like this off. So, is Bol Bol sort of the Michael Porter of this draft, Mike? I mean, he's not maybe as talented, but that kind of decision?
I think so. And I'm not sure that he needs to redshirt. You know, maybe that's in the plans if you are a team that has, you know, players ready and you have multiple picks like the Celtics or like the Hawks. But I'm not sure he needs to miss an entire season either.
He's already missed most of a season.
Right. I'm not sure he needs to sit out his entire rookie season. But, you know, almost as concerning is the fact that he weighed 208 pounds, you know, at the combine. Like a 7'3 guy weighing 208 pounds, I think that's just a little concerning in terms of his ability to maintain weight, because last summer he was over 230. At the Nike Academy, and you know, to lose 26 pounds, some of that is obviously because you're sitting out, but I think there are some concerns about, you know, just his body type and ability to hold up over 82 games in addition to that foot injury. But I think there are some parallels to what you're saying for sure with Porter in terms of like high upside guy, injury questions, and I think you could argue he's every bit as talented, honestly.
So, Bobby, the Hawks have six picks in this draft, three in each round. The Celtics have four picks, three firsts and a second. You don't think that they're making all those picks, right?
No. And don't forget about Philly, too, Bri. One in the first and, what, four in the second?
Yeah, they have – Philly has picks 33 and 34. Considering where their payroll is going, they may want to hit on picks 33 and 34.
Well, you're right. That's your bench.
And
in Atlanta either. I mean, like, you know, based on, you know, you take all three of these guys. Now you've got, I think, eight players on rookie contracts.
which is, you know, I mean, it's great as far as timing, you know, when you can make, if this team develops and you can go out and get a free agent down the road next year. But that's a big ask for Lloyd Pierce, not even including those second rounders. That's a major, you know, that's, you better hire a lot of player development.
That's why they're going to keep Vince Carter.
Schmitz, Bobby, Brian, like, what's one thing you're looking for when this draft comes through? Like, what's the one thing that you're curious about that you don't have an answer to right now?
I want to know who's got the number four pick. to me, that's a big thing that's still hanging out there. What's going to happen to number four?
Yeah, we just hit on it, but where Bol Bol goes is something that is fascinating to me. I've been watching this kid since he was, you know, early on in his high school years. And like I said, he's really like a top five talent in this draft. And it's hard to find guys that size who can do what he does, you know. So, but are people going to be willing to swing? Or is he a guy who's actually going to go, you know, in the 20s? So he's the most fascinating player.
That, 7'3", you can shoot the three, right? That's the sketch on him. Is that
I shoot the three, but not just like pick and pop and have a million years to shoot it, right? Like he can like hezzy pull up threes like a point guard, you know. He's a complete natural. But you know, there are questions about the motor and all that. But he's this. Extremely, extremely polarizing guy, as much as I can really remember in the last few years.
Bobby, his dad was ahead of his time. Minute at the end of his career shot threes all the time. Loved sure shooting did. Threes.
Played in the old, what was it, the Cap Center?
Cap Center.
The old days. I think, Andrew, for me, I think the most interesting or what I'm watching is Kevin Porter Jr. from USC. I mean, I think, like, Mike, don't correct me if I'm wrong, but like, I mean, he's got lottery talent. I mean, he really
top 10 talent.
Yeah. Top 10 talent, and you know, teams are scared off about his background, immature, you know, as far as his 1 year at USC. And like I could see a team like Miami at 13, right? Like kind of mm-hmm. like putting him into that system down there, the Pat Riley DNA culture. But if not, he's almost like a guy that could like a quarterback who gets not picked in his slot and then takes a little bit of a free fall there and maybe into the late teens, early 20s.
So this is like tangentially related to the draft at best, but when that Anthony Davis trade went down, one of the first things that went through my head, and I don't know why this happened, Bobby, but like, it was you getting sweats about the draft conversation.
Yeah, he tweeted about it.
One of the first things that went through my head was like, I need the check for the chicken quesadilla I'm eating right now. I was sitting at the bar at the Double Deal, you know, our favorite, the old Double Tree in Bristol. And I saw the tweet and I was like, check. And I'm like running out of the room to, but yeah, you know, it's funny, like with pick swaps is that you never think what the consequences are going to be, right? Like down the road, especially like the pick swaps in what, 23 for the New Orleans trade in 2023, I think. And then it's the first is deferred in 24 to 25. And, you know, we always had a running joke, and it's probably not funny, but it's like, you know, hey, it will be someone else's mess to clean up down the road. And like, that's how sometimes teams look at that, right? Like you're looking at it now and that you're not, you're always think you're going to be good, right? For the, you know, you don't think about injuries. You think your roster, you're going to be able to put players together. And I think this is a little different than our, you know, we didn't have Anthony Davis. I mean, we had Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce and Jason Terry. I mean, they got Anthony Davis for at least for the next, you know, this year and probably five more years here.
One of my favorite things about that trade that nobody remembers was the contract that
Keith Bogans
got free money, right? And what was Chris Humphrey's deal? You signed him with the hope that you could trade him. He'd already been signed. What was that?
2 years, $24 million.
Right, which was an overpay, right?
For yes. Him? Well, we tried doing it the year before, and nobody would take him. It was 1 year for $12 million, and then we did it again for like 2 years. 2 years, I think 2 years, $24 million. And yeah, Keith Bogans was to make the money work. He was a sign and trade and got $5 million and didn't have to do anything.
$5 million. The all time great sign and trade though was Keith Van Horn.
And that's why they changed the rule.
Right, they changed the rule. But what trade was that, Bobby?
That was the Jason Kidd trade of 2008. We traded Kidd to Dallas, and we wound up getting Devin Harris. And to make the money work, we took back Keith Van Horn because he was on their roster. But I don't think he had played like a year or two, right?
He wasn't on their roster. He was just sort of
he was a free agent.
He was tired. He was retired, but not retired. I mean, he was like fly fishing
in Colorado.
And they were like, "Hey, can you come and sign? How much did you get? How much did he have to?" The reason they had to do it was they didn't have enough money to balance the trade. So they still had his rights. You have a player's rights until you renounce them. So he hadn't played in a year. How much do you remember how much he got?
I'll tell you right now.
So they literally they called him in from the river, the fly fishing river, and signed. They were like, "Hey, would you like a free like $3 million or something like that?"
We signed. It was a sign and trade because you have to be 3 years in a sign and trade. It was a 3 years, $11.3 million in the first year that he got. Oh, and the beauty of it too, Brian, is that he was signed. This is why they changed the rule too. He was signed on February 19th for $4.2 million. That was not prorated. So basically he got that for 2 months and he came in and he sat in our media room and read a book until the league, until the league sent someone over and we had to put him on a treadmill.
I remember that. Like didn't they make him like at least sit on the bench or something like that?
I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, he was like, "Though, how about we give you $4 million, but we prorate it?" No. You're going to give me the full $4 million if you want me to come in from this river.
Yeah, oh, all right. We actually had to negotiate with David Falk on that. It was like, "Dave, we're going to give him like $4 million for nothing."
And Falk's like, "What? Falk wanted $5 million, probably." He's. We got that soft sidetrack. That's one of my favorite all-time NBA moments. All right. Well, thank you, guys. A lot of work being done here, and I can sit back and enjoy it because I just don't know enough about the draft. I always say I don't know these players until I see them in Summer League, and to be honest with you, I don't even really see them until they play in the league for the most part because Summer League is hard to really judge them. But that's why we have Schmitz out there and Gavoni, and you guys will have a lot of great content and television appearances. And Bobby, your sleep is going to be minimized for the next 3 to 5 weeks. So I hope you you're going to be working
that touch screen. I'll be the weatherman for the next 3 weeks.
I know that there's lots of touchscreen practice. How do you feel your touchscreen practice is going?
I feel a lot better than I did a year ago. I'll tell you that.
Okay. all right. I've used it a little bit, nowhere near how much you used it. And I found it, I'm going to be quite honest with you, I found it horrifying because it doesn't seem like it reacts the same way twice, even though it's like a $100,000 screen. But it's kind of like one of those second round draft picks that you bought. All right. Thanks, guys, a lot. Good luck. Get some rest, and I will look forward to everything. And thank you for listening to the Hoop Collective podcast.